Welcome to the On Science podcast. I'm Deborah Franklin, sitting in today for Allison Richards. An eclectic mix of science this week, we'll look at the changing fortunes of nuclear power. For a long time, the nuclear option was off the table, but not anymore. We'll also hear about how genetically engineered crops have changed American farming, how the brain does, or rather doesn't, manage to juggle more than one task at a time. We'll dig into the world of quantum mechanics to find a truly random number. And we'll have a report on birds with backpacks. But first, nuclear technology. 50 years ago, it seemed as if nuclear power would solve all our energy problems. Then there were problems with plant safety and concerns about nuclear proliferation and what to do with nuclear waste. Global warming changed the equation. Yes, there are problems with nuclear power, but nuclear plants don't produce greenhouse gases. Christopher Joyce has a report on the nuclear side of the Obama administration's energy plan and what it could cost to give a new life to an industry that's been treading water for 30 years.
The threat of global warming might be the best thing ever to happen to nuclear energy. For 3 decades, no one built a new plant in the U.S., though they built some abroad. Now nuclear looks better because it doesn't emit greenhouse gases that warm the planet. But nuclear power still scares lots of banks and investors. Leslie Cass, Director of Business Policy at the industry's Nuclear Energy Institute, gives 2 reasons.
One would be some of the unknowns because we haven't built here in 30 years, and they want to watch the licensing process work, and they want to prove us at our word that we can replicate what's happened overseas.
And number 2, the cost. Cass says American utility companies tend to be smaller than their foreign counterparts. They don't have as much cash, so they have to borrow more, and the typical nuclear project runs, $10 billion, give or take.
Once you start borrowing almost as much as your net worth, you get penalized by the rating agencies. Your rating goes down, and then your access to capital, the cost of that goes up.
So the Department of Energy is offering a carrot to investors. If a nuclear project goes belly up, the government will pay them back up to 80% of their financial loss. Cass and DOE says this will help kickstart the industry. But groups such as Taxpayers for Common Sense and environmental organizations say taxpayers are getting a raw deal here. Nuclear projects have gone belly up or way over budget elsewhere. A congressional study in 2003 said a 50% failure rate for nuclear projects isn't an unreasonable estimate. The U.S. industry says it's actually far less than that, but no one knows for sure. So the government now says, okay, we'll offer something more to encourage investors to part with their cash. We'll make the utilities and developers first pay an upfront fee
to account for the risk to the federal government that the nuclear developer defaults on the loan.
That's Richard Caperton, a policy analyst with the Center for American Progress, a liberal think tank in Washington. Here's the tricky part, though. How much should that fee be? The industry proposes 1% of the loan guarantee. So, for a typical project, a developer might pay an upfront fee of $80 million. If the project dies, the taxpayer would be responsible for the rest of the loss, probably several billion dollars. Caperton and other analysts say 1% is way too low. He recommends developers pay a 10% fee, or $800 million, for a typical project. And that may be more than any utility can afford to pay.
It seems unlikely to me that they would be able to get any sort of low-risk financing for the $800 million. So you can see where it becomes a big problem.
So right now, the future of the nuclear industry hangs in part on what DOE and utilities decide that fee will be. Even if the fee is acceptable, nuclear developers can't depend on government help for very long, though. DOE says it's just for the first few projects. Then the industry will have to swim on its own. Nuclear analyst Matthew Bunn at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government says it'll have to be a long swim for nuclear power to slow global warming. Right now, he says, only 4 new nuclear plants are built every year worldwide.
We have to shift from that to something like 25 every year from now until 2050 if we want to provide even, say, 10% of the carbon-free energy that's going to be needed to address the climate change problem.
Bunn says that kind of building spree, at least in the U.S., isn't likely. But Charles Forsberg, an engineer at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, says what's important is just getting nuclear power back on its feet.
The importance of the number of plants in the next 10 years is not total electric production, but what it sets in place, the licenses, the knowledge, the manufacturing facilities, is it enables you to rapidly expand thereafter.
Ultimately, the climate bill in Congress could tip the balance for utilities, not by making nuclear cheaper, but by slapping a stiff price on carbon from coal and natural gas. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
A Blue Ribbon committee recently found that, on the whole, the crops produced through genetic engineering benefit the farmers who plant them. But the committee also warns that farmers could lose some of those benefits if the technology isn't carefully managed. Richard Harris reports.
Over the past 14 years, three of this nation's biggest cash crops have quietly become genetically engineered crops. These days, 80% of the corn, cotton, and soybeans are the products of biotech. Other studies have looked at public perceptions of this technology and the health and social issues that it raises, but the National Academy of Sciences noted that nobody had tried to take a broad look at how this technology affects farmers.
We think that the farmer's perspective is crucial in this respect, because they're the ones using the technology, have the most to potentially gain, and perhaps some risks involved.
David Irvin from Portland State University in Oregon chaired the National Research Council's exploration of the subject, and from the viewpoint of the farmers, the results are largely quite positive.
What we found is the farmers who have adopted these genetically engineered crops have received both environmental and economic benefits.
Though genetically engineered seeds often cost more, the farmers more than make up for that because they use less labor and fewer chemicals to produce their crops. And the report finds the farm environment benefits because farmers can reduce the use of pesticides on pest-resistant genetically engineered crops. They can also reduce soil erosion caused by tilling by instead using herbicides to control weeds.
One of the herbicides that's very popular in the genetically engineered crops, glyphosate, is less toxic than many of the herbicides that it replaces.
Glyphosate, known by the brand name Roundup, is, if anything, getting too popular, the report finds, and that gets us to a potential downside of the technology, herbicide resistance.
That's a serious concern. In fact, one of the strong messages in our report and findings is that we have to take very seriously the high level of resistance of weeds to glyphosate. And there's an increasing number of weeds and an increasing extent of area where we see this.
If that trend continues, farmers may find themselves falling back on more environmentally damaging herbicides or going back to tilling their fields and sacrificing soil in the process. Irvin says there are measures to manage this problem, but they're not being used effectively. Irvin would also like to see biotech used for broader social benefits, such as crops that need less fertilizer.
And if we can get plants to be more efficient in how they use their fertilizer and have less fertilizer runoff, it not only benefits the farmer by reducing their fertilizer application bill, but it also benefits the downstream user of waters who have less polluted runoff.
Irvin emphasized that the panel decided not to go back and look at the health and environmental concerns raised a decade ago when the technology was taking off. The worst fears there have not come to pass. But Margaret Mellon, at an advocacy group called the Union of Concerned Scientists, still isn't overly enthusiastic about biotech crops.
I look at the technology in light of what it promised, and we all, including myself, really expected from it 20 years ago when it first came on the scene.
Hopes were high that it would altogether transform agriculture, with higher yielding crops and fields that required a lot less spray and less fertilizer.
In light of what we expected the technology to do, its performance is really very disappointing.
It turns out that most of those highly desirable traits are complicated and more likely to arise from conventional plant breeding, Mellon says. So she's disappointed that so much enthusiasm has shifted away from conventional breeding to new and high-tech genetic engineering. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Think of a number from 1 to 10, any number. Okay, did you pick that number because it randomly popped into your head, or it's your nephew's age, or maybe the time you woke up this morning? It turns out creating a truly random number is surprisingly hard. In fact, in most cases, it's impossible. But randomness is essential for some security programs. And a report Joe Palca did this week shows how scientists are using the random behavior of atoms under the rules of quantum mechanics to generate truly random numbers. The story starts in NPR's virtual casino.
How about a game of chance, like roulette? Now, which number the ball falls on may seem like a random event. But Antonio Assin from the Institute of Photonic Science in Barcelona says it's not. Because, like every device, it follows physical rules that can be worked out.
If you are able to compute the initial position and the speed of the ball, and you have a perfect model for the roulette, then you can predict where the ball is going to finish with certainty.
Assin says everything we call random in our world may just appear random because of lack of knowledge. But there is one place where true randomness does exist. That's the world of atoms and electrons and the laws of quantum mechanics. Or to be more precise,
non-local correlations of entangled quantum particles.
The non-local correlations of entangled quantum particles. Okay, let me try to explain. The laws of quantum mechanics say some things truly are random. Take the clicks you hear from a Geiger counter. These are bursts of energy coming from decaying atoms.
Those are random due to quantum mechanics.
Chris Munro of the University of Maryland is Assin's co-author on this study. The random clicks of a Geiger counter can be used to generate random numbers by measuring the intervals between the clicks. True random numbers are crucial for devising secret codes, or else the codes can be cracked by clever computers. But Munro says there's a problem with using a Geiger counter. You never know if it has some electrical flaw throwing off the randomness.
A stronger form of random number generators are those that produce random numbers that are so-called device independent. It doesn't matter what's inside the box.
This is where you can take advantage of the weird properties of quantum mechanics. For example, in the quantum world, a magnet can point north and south at the same time, just as long as you don't look at it.
When you do look, it randomly pops into one or the other.
And if you can capture that random popping, you have a true random number generator. So Munro took an atom. It happened to be ytterbium.
It has an outer electron that is very much like a bar magnet. It can be north up or south up.
But in order to capture that randomness, you have to entangle two ytterbium atoms, yoke them together in a quantum sense. Why? Because work by Albert Einstein and another physicist named John Bell says you have to. That's why. It wasn't easy. As reported in Nature, it took 3 weeks of running their equipment round the clock to get just 42 random events, 42 ups or downs that could be turned into zeros or ones that were truly, totally, 100% random. If the generator can be speeded up, cryptographers are likely to find it useful. Antonio Assin says a casino operator who wants to prove he's running an honest operation could find it helpful too.
I prepare for him two entangled particles. Now he takes these entangled particles, he goes to his lab, he knows he can generate randomness out of them.
Of course, random or not, the house still gets a cut. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Multitaskers may want to focus on several goals at once, but our brains can't keep up, according to a paper in the journal Science. Brain scans suggest that even holding two goals in mind is a stretch. Three at a time? Impossible. John Hamilton has more.
Let's say you're at your computer, working on an urgent report for your boss.
But you also have your email open, and one email comes in from a good friend who may be inviting you to go to a restaurant.
You could just ignore the email, says René Magua of Vanderbilt University. After all, your primary goal is to finish the report. Or your brain could do a form of multitasking. It could create a sort of mental bookmark of your current thoughts about the report while you pause long enough to answer the email.
Whether you're going to do the other task while maintaining your primary goal depends on the rewards associated with checking that email.
And matters involving goals and rewards generally involve areas in the brain's frontal lobes. So a French team decided to look at these areas while people tried to multitask. Their tasks involved shapes and letters, not reports and emails, and their motivation was money, sometimes tiny amounts, sometimes a full euro for doing a task perfectly. Etienne Queclin of the École Normale Supérieure in Paris says when people were doing just one task, their left and right frontal lobes seemed to work together to achieve the goal. But when people took on a second task, he says, the lobes divided their responsibilities.
Each frontal lobe were pursuing its own goal.
and responding to its own reward, says Magua, who is familiar with the work but was not involved in the research.
So the left hemisphere represented the reward for the first task, and the right hemisphere represented the information to the second task.
The greater the reward, the greater the activity. But the brain has only two frontal lobes, suggesting perhaps that there might be a limit to the number of goals and rewards it can handle. So the team decided to do another experiment. Magua says they offered people rewards to do three things at once.
So you had to hold information about two tasks while executing a third one. And essentially, people miserably failed at this task.
When they started a third task, one of the original goals disappeared from their brains. The French team says that suggests the brain simply can't stay focused on more than two goals at a time. But David Meyer, who studies multitasking at the University of Michigan, isn't so sure.
I don't think there's any evidence to prove that under all conditions, people can't keep three goals in mind. It's very important to distinguish between do not under some circumstances and cannot under any circumstances.
Meyer says the brain might respond differently if the motivation was, say, survival instead of pocket money. He's also puzzled by what he sees as a disconnect between what was happening in people's brains and what they actually did. For example, offering people more money increased their brain activity quite a bit. But Meyer says the extra brain activity didn't make people much faster or more accurate at their tasks.
The effects of these motivational manipulations on the behavior were extremely small for the most part.
Which means that we may not be much good at doing only two things at once, even when our brains really, really want to. The new study appears in the journal Science. John Hamilton, NPR News.
It can be mesmerizing to watch a flock of birds soaring through the air when suddenly the entire flock veers off in a new direction, as if the birds had magically made a group decision. Scientists have wondered a long time how that happens, so recently a team of them decided to track individual pigeons in a flock. As Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, they outfitted each bird with a GPS device in a tiny little backpack.
The birds in this study were about a dozen homing pigeons, kept by a fancier who lives in Hungary. They looked very cute in their tiny, custom-made backpacks.
You have to imagine sort of a backpack where the straps fit around the wings and the kind of compartment sits on the back.
Dora Biro is a scientist at the University of Oxford who did this study with colleagues in Hungary. She says, at first, the pigeons would peck at the backpacks.
I mean, you know, this isn't something that they would experience naturally, so they do sort of investigate the backpacks initially, but very quickly they get used to them.
It helped that the backpacks weren't heavy. Inside was a GPS device that weighed about half an ounce, but it could record a bird's position five times a second. Biro says without this information, there'd be no way of knowing who in the flock shifted direction first and how the others responded.
The decisions that are made and that spread through the group are made at such short timescales that it's really not visible easily to the naked eye.
And you can't just assume that the birds out in front are calling the shots.
Birds have a very wide angle of vision, so for them it is possible that they would be responding to birds who are flying behind them.
So to see if pigeons might be following a leader or leaders, the researchers analyzed all of the data logged by the GPS devices during short flights and longer journeys.
I guess from the beginning, we weren't sure whether we were going to find any kind of consistent leader-follower relationship. But in fact, to us surprisingly, we did.
She says for any given pair of birds,
you can accurately work out which one of them is the leader and which one of them is the follower.
Some birds had more followers than others. This created a hierarchy of influence within the flock.
Basically, every individual gets a kind of a vote in what the flock does, but the weight of your vote depends on your rank, your position in the hierarchy.
And it turns out the birds with the most rank tended to fly out in front. The results of this study are reported in the journal Nature. Biro says it's not clear what makes a pigeon a great leader in the air. Maybe some birds have a better sense of direction or just fly faster. But the study does show that in these flocks, not all birds were equal. That's what some scientists have assumed when making computer models that use simple rules to mimic the behavior of flocks. Ian Cousin is a researcher at Princeton University who studies how groups of animals make decisions.
Individual differences really matter, and that's what people are beginning to realize. And so I think this work sort of paves new ground in that, you know, we're all sort of getting interested in how individual differences really matter and how they relate to collective dynamics.
He says while birds are famous for their pecking orders on the ground, this study was able to use new technology to show that something similar happens in flight. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
And that's all for On Science. If you would like to hear or read more stories, you can visit our website, npr.org/science. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. I'm Deborah Franklin.